It's funny how a composer's reputation can fluctuate as the decades go by. When I first fell in love with classical music as a teenager, one of the go-to sets of reference books in my local library was the Master Musicians series. Each of the leading composers in Western classical music history got a volume to themselves, except when it came to Bruckner. His life and musical legacy were only allotted half a volume. The honours were shared with a certain other Viennese composer who, like Bruckner, also composed 9 substantial late Romantic symphonies, Gustav Mahler. What's changed in the intervening years is that Mahler's reputation has gone stratospheric. He's now regarded as one of the most popular orchestral composers ever, his music the backbone of many a symphonic season, year on year. But where does this leave Bruckner's reputation? Well, his music is often performed too, although his status is hardly on a par with Mahler's. Part of the reason for this is the fact that even during his lifetime, Bruckner wasn't as articulate or as confident by comparison. Even in his day and age, how you sold yourself and your music was an important consideration. To say that Bruckner wasn't brilliant at self-publicity would be the understatement of the year. And during this interval, I'm going to be exploring how that might have affected the reception of his music over the long term, which, whether you like it or not, is an important consideration. It would be lovely, wouldn't it, to live in a world in which deeply spiritual music like this could speak for itself. Anton Bruckner was born in 1824 and died in 1896. And although he spent the last 28 years of his life in Vienna, he came from quite a different culture. Bruckner was a country boy at heart, something that's painfully obvious when you look at full-length portraits of him as an adult, with close-cropped hair, wearing outsized jackets, baggy trousers and hobnail boots. The vagaries of urban fashion were clearly passing him by. His birthplace was well away from the sophistication of the capital, in Upper Austria, the small town of Ansfelden, near Linz. There he began life by following in the footsteps of his schoolmaster and organist father, who got him started on his musical journey by teaching him how to play hymn tunes on a miniature violin when he was just 4. Young Anton then graduated to the family spinet, and then by the age of 10, he was substituting for his father by playing the organ at church services. Occasionally, as a treat, his parents would take him to the nearby Augustinian monastery of St. Florian, where you could hear music on a grander scale in its imposing chapel. And many years later, Bruckner was appointed to the job of chief organist there, meaning that he could leave his post as a village schoolmaster behind him. Bruckner was a late starter. It was only gradually that he started to compose on a serious basis. By the time he travelled to Vienna to organise proper composition lessons for himself, he was past 30 years of age. Bruckner, though, was nothing if not a hard worker. For the rest of his 30s, he held down a job as organist at Linz Cathedral, with all the demands that entailed, while setting aside 7 hours a day to work on harmony and counterpoint exercises. They'd been set for him by Simon Sechter, who was composition professor at the Vienna Conservatory and who had taken Bruckner on as a private pupil, tutoring him on a sort of correspondence course. We might think of the Romantic era as one of free-flowing individualism, but somehow this news didn't seem to have filtered down to Sechter. He used to insist that his students, who had included such big names as the violinist Henri Vieuxtemps and the conductor Franz Lachner, didn't write any original music at all during their time studying with them, just sticking to their diet of harmony and counterpoint exercises. A musical case of not running before you can walk, I suppose. An approach that might have had an unforeseen positive outcome in Bruckner's case. The composer and scholar Robert Simpson believes that Sechter unknowingly brought about Bruckner's originality by insisting that it be suppressed until it could no longer be contained. One consequence of Bruckner studying so hard at his exercises, even his teacher Sechter, who was a hard taskmaster, got a bit worried that he was working too hard, is that when he stepped out of that straitjacket, so to speak, the effect on him could be overwhelming. That was the case in 1863, as Bruckner approached his 40th birthday. A performance of Wagner's recent opera Tannhäuser was scheduled for Linz. Bruckner went to the first performance of the run, and the effect of the music just blew him away. He suddenly realised what a composer could do when, instead of following all the preordained rules of harmonic progression, you could just break them. He was also impressed by two other elements of Wagner's music: the colours that he was able to draw from his enormous orchestra, and the idea that a single piece of music could be written on such a gigantic scale. Bruckner, though, just took what he wanted from Wagner's example. While Wagner himself saw music as just one constituent part of an art form that drew all of the arts together to make one narrative dramatic whole, Bruckner really wasn't interested in all of that. For him, Wagner's ideas of onstage drama were secondary to what the music itself was doing in its long, slow transformations and repeated evocation of tension and release. These elements eventually led to an easily recognisable style that was Bruckner's alone, which partly harked back to his musical origins in the organ loft. So often in his symphonies, Bruckner treats the orchestra like an organ, operating in massive slices of sound. So there were the church influences, the solid system of compositional training, and the powerful influence of Wagner's music. I'd say all of the essential parts of the Bruckner style were in place by 1868, when Bruckner moved to Vienna at the age of 44 to teach at the conservatory. Something which Bruckner hadn't yet learned and never would learn was how to cope with the sophistication of his new home and how to adapt his manners accordingly. And there's no doubt that Bruckner's inability to play the game in Vienna held up recognition of his music for many years. Not only was it a question of dressing smartly, I mentioned the hobnailed boots earlier on, but talking smartly too. When it came to other people, Bruckner was painfully subservient and awkward. Stories about his gauche behaviour are legion. Max Graf, who went on to become Vienna's leading music critic, remembered that when the Angelus rang during Bruckner's lectures, he would break off to get down on his knees and pray. At the end of the Vienna Philharmonic Orchestra's first performance of his Fourth Symphony, Bruckner went up to the immensely distinguished conductor Hans Richter and gave him a tip, squeezing a gulden into Richter's hand. "Take it, drink a pitcher of beer to my health," Bruckner said. Richter wore the coin on his watch chain as a memento for the rest of his life. And then there was Bruckner's worship of Wagner. The dedication of Bruckner's Third Symphony reads, "To the eminent excellency Richard Wagner, the unattainable, world-famous and exalted master of poetry and music, in deepest reverence dedicated by Anton Bruckner." After he heard Wagner's late great music drama Parsifal for the first time, Bruckner actually fell on his knees in front of Wagner and said, "Master, I worship you," which must have been ever so slightly awkward. Not everyone in Vienna worshipped Wagner, though. Opinions there were strongly expressed and sharply divided. The sharpest tongue there, or perhaps I should say the sharpest nib, belonged to Eduard Hanslick. Highly articulate and deeply conservative, he served as critic of Vienna's key newspaper, the Neue Freie Presse, for 40 years until 1904. For him, music began with Mozart and ended with Beethoven, Schumann and Brahms. Anything later than that, and anything more progressive, he just had no time for. Music should be an end in itself, as far as Hanslick was concerned, and not the jumping-off points for drama and poetry. He felt that the forward-looking music of Liszt and Wagner were abominations. To give you just one example, here's what Hanslick had to say about Bruckner's Eighth Symphony after its premiere in 1892. "Characteristic of Bruckner's newest symphony," Hanslick wrote, "is the immediate juxtaposition of dry schoolroom counterpoint with unbounded exaltation. Thus, tossed about between intoxication and desolation, we arrive at no definite impression and enjoy no artistic pleasure. Everything flows, without clarity and without order, willy-nilly, into dismal long-windedness." The key work for Bruckner, though, was the one that came before it, the Seventh Symphony. It was first performed when the composer was 60, and it single-handedly established Bruckner's reputation, at long last, as a great composer who should be taken seriously. Both the first performance under the great conductor Arto Nikisch in Leipzig in 1884 and the second in Munich the following year were great successes. Up until then, the Viennese had been rather snooty about Bruckner and his music, but the success of the Seventh finally convinced them they had a great composer in their midst. The symphony itself bears witness to how important Wagner had been to Bruckner's work. In it, Bruckner uses a quartet of Wagner tubas in the orchestra for the first time. Wagner tubas, by the way, in case you're not familiar with them, are instruments with a hauntingly rich sound, traditionally played by members of the orchestra's horn section. They make their first appearance in the sombre second slow movement. As Bruckner was completing it, he heard that Wagner had died, and so he added a poignant coda to bring the movement to an elegiac and desolate close.
Thank you.
This work, Bruckner's Seventh, was the one that helped tip the balance towards acceptance of Bruckner's music, and it has the hallmark of Bruckner's idol on it. Although Wagner himself thought that the symphony was old hat and no longer bothering with, as Bruckner and others showed, there was plenty of life in it yet, right through into the start of the 20th century. And yes, they could work on a broad canvas and with sumptuous scoring and musical arguments that unfolded ever so slowly. In some ways, Bruckner's mindset would have been out of place 2 decades before, with its deep religious faith and unassuming modesty. And yet in other ways, Bruckner showed that he could lead the agenda, co-opting and developing some of the most up-to-date musical methods around. Do we have Bruckner to thank for creating the symphonies that Wagner never wrote?